If you are familiar with the works of the writer André Debus III, forgive me a moment while I catch up the rest of the audience, because people who are not so familiar with the author's works might at least recognize the title House of Sand and Fog. That was made into a movie with Jennifer Connelly and Ben Kingsley and nominated for an Oscar or two. It was based upon a book by André Debus III, and he's visiting Ashland today, preparing for a speaking engagement tonight at 7:30 at Ashland High School, sponsored by Chautauqua Poets and Writers. André Debus III not only writes a great deal of material, he teaches other people how to write full-time at the University of Massachusetts Lowell campus, and he's in the studio with me. André Debus, good to meet you.
Good to meet you. Glad for having me. Thank you.
So first off, people have to be careful when Googling André Debus, obviously. They can easily end up with the wrong picture, the wrong list of works, and the wrong idea about you. That's your father, who divorced your mother when you were young. Any assumption growing up that you would be a writer, too?
Yeah, probably. I mean, you know, I am his oldest son, and I am the proud son of André Debus, who was a master short story writer. He died almost 20 years ago. He published 10 books. But yeah, I'm kind of the Hank Jr., Hank III of American Lit. It has not always been easy, but there are worse problems to have.
But you have really made your own distinctive stamp at this point. I mean,
yeah, you know. I think I probably have. I do think, you know, and I talk about this in writing classes, you know, if there's any one enemy to creativity, it might be self-consciousness. And I think it's really important not to think about yourself too much and just try to get the work done and, you know, let in these spirits called characters.
I read something about the level of self-consciousness, that particularly as you get older, and something that I find, too, just as a human being, that you get a little less, you know, cutesy about notice me, that kind of thing.
Don't you?
See, yeah. So I just wonder, I mean, how, as a younger writer, do you work that stuff out of there and be able to focus on the other people that you are writing about?
I think that's a profoundly good question, because I think especially now with social media and all that, I think self-consciousness is at a prime. People are always, you know, taking selfies and you know, posting this and posting that. And I think that we're kind of toxically self-conscious right now. And I'm not being critical. I'm just observing. Hear it that way. So for a young writer who's doing all that, I think it's really hard now to let go and just surrender to the spirits on the page. Look, it's going to sound morbid, but I don't mean it to sound morbid. You know, we're not going to last forever. And don't you want to write something really good, at least one good thing? And so, you know, I think it's important that we teach ourselves how to get out of the way. You know, what I try to do in my classes is get young people and not so young people just to surrender to the beauty of writing a sentence that might capture what's inside you and get it out to someone else. And it's really a sweet and enjoyable experience. And so I think if you focus on that, you're focused less on being an author and more on being a writer.
So talk about that process. I mean, you're dealing with students who live in the social media world that you're talking about, where people are constantly self-conscious. I mean, do you tell everybody, keep your phones hidden from my view while you're in the class?
In fact, I do.
Do you?
Yeah, and I have to share with you, Jeff, I've never texted. I am a...
You said that coming in.
I
was hoping
you'd get to
that.
Social media. Look, you know, my kids, we've got three kids, and, you know, their gadgets are sewn into their arms, and my wife's got one, and everybody I know and love has one, and I'm not judging anyone. I have to say, though, I find it heartbreaking that so many of us stare at small objects in our hands all day. I think it's really, I feel as if I'm walking into an opium den and everyone's high and I'm not. So I tell my students, I said, look, man, we're here for a short time on this planet. Do you want to, and I think the only thing we have is this one moment. This one moment you and I have is it. It's it. And there's nothing else. And so I'm not a fan of the gadgets. I'm not. And so I try to get them to turn them. They do. They're not allowed in my class. They turn them off.
Is there any value, though, in the fact that at least people are communicating through the use of words? I mean, they are texting each other. They are using social media. They're writing narratives, even if they're not particularly.
I'm glad you said that. I do. That is the silver lining for me. I do like that at least they're it's with their thumbs, but they're writing. I was on a panel with a young writer, Joshua Ferris, really wonderful young writer. His recent novel, he wrote the entire thing on his phone.
I've heard about that.
The entire thing on his phone. I write longhand pencil and Mead composition notebooks from 1963, for crying out loud.
I was going to ask you if you're the kind of guy who types with the two index fingers.
I do.
Do you really?
Yeah,
so what's the problem with the thumbs if you're using just the index
fingers?
No,
I have no problem with it. And by the way, I have no problem with the internet. I love the internet. I mean, it's you know, the research capability alone is wonderful. And you know, I love what we can do on these computers. I just hate that they've ended up in our hands and people are walking around in a trance. You know, there's a law passed in Connecticut, in a town in Connecticut, that you cannot walk and text because 8 people have gotten killed in the last 5 years stepping in front of traffic, staring at their iPhones in their hands.
What town is this?
It'll come to me. It's a pretty big town.
Okay, because I went to high school in Connecticut.
Yeah, it's one of the big ones. It'll come to me.
Is it in Greenwich or something?
No, it was. Yeah. Might be, who knows?
Somewhere around, yeah. All right, so, social media and this world, isn't it interesting, though, that in the world where you were talking about the internet for research, the idea that in your hand now you contain pretty much all of the world's knowledge.
Yeah, which is fascinating.
At this moment.
Yeah.
And yet people will get something on social media and go, I can't believe this, and they'll react emotionally without checking on this device in their hand that has all this information.
Yeah, I think we live in a hazardous and kind of beautiful time. It's strange. We're living in a really strange... I don't think we've begun to even feel the social implications of what this technology is doing to us. But I'm not a total Luddite. I'm not against all... I'm against people falling into the addiction that keeps them from looking at someone across from them and talking, listening, looking at the way the sun is setting on that telephone pole. Oh, look, crying child underneath the hedge over there. Yeah, I think that if writing does nothing, if it does nothing, it should wake us up, and I think that's what reading does too.
I read that same sort of attitude in previous interviews, but it's something that strikes me with all the writers who come in here who've done it for a living is that they're so observant. I mean, the little details matter as much as the big ones.
Sometimes the little details are the big details, right? You know, they're everything. You know, I'm not really observant except when I'm writing. When I'm writing, I try to be really observant, but I was teaching at a grad class in Boston years ago, and I asked one of my students to describe an object in the room. She said the grand piano. I said, no, in this room. She said the grand piano. I said, no, this. I've been teaching that room for 8 years. I never noticed there's a grand piano in the corner. So I don't know how observant I am.
Andre Dubuse III is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He comes to Ashland tonight for a performance appearance at Ashland High School. It could be a performance, too. I don't have to bring tap shoes or anything. But 7:30 at Ashland High School, brought here by Chautauqua Poets and Writers. You can join the conversation on the Exchange when we come back. As we go to the break, let me remind you, it is fall fund drive time here on JPR. Looking for $200,000 in pledges. We just crossed $66,000. We finish up on Wednesday. 1-888-552-6191 to pledge by phone, online. It's at ijpr.org. Back in a minute, 5. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Andre Dubuse III, who is the writer of several works of fiction, most recently Dirty Love, a collection of stories. Before that, The Garden of Last Days, House of Sand and Fog, Blues Man, and The Cage Keeper, and other stories. He's also written a memoir called Townie, and an anthology he's contributed to, Blood, Root, Knit, Pearl. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You were talking about connecting with other human beings, and you've had a number of jobs over the years, and it sounds like, did you do some bartending? Was that part of it?
I was a bartender, house cleaner, halfway house counselor. I was actually assistant bounty hunter, private investigator, which sounds like I'm making it up, but it's true. I was this is in Colorado, and I worked with a guy who only hunted down violent guys because it was more money. And I went looking for a really scary guy in Mexico. And I took this job because I liked to write in the morning, and it was all night work. I did surveillance on the girlfriend of a contract killer.
Uh-huh.
I'm actually not making this up. And I'm sitting in my little Toyota outside her apartment, watching her and taking notes for the investigators, and squeezing a little writing, looking up, writing a few more sentences. It was weird, yeah.
So you're always writing. I guess that was where I was leading with the question.
I began in my early 20s, and I had too many use. I grew up poor with a single mother, and lived in a lot of tough neighborhoods, and had a lot of violence in my life, and I became a fighter. And let me explain that. I mean, I did some boxing, but it was I didn't do any sanctioned bouts. I was mainly defending myself and my family, and I hated violence, and I would find myself looking for trouble all the time. But I would look for someone who was, beating up his girlfriend or his some small guy, and I'd go nuts at him. And it was not good. I got a lot of social rewards, but I was on a route that was going to get me killed or put in prison or both. And so it's a long story, but I found writing, and it saved me. It gave me another way to express myself. I was in my early 20s, and, you know, as a consequence, I'm a real sucker for tough kids. I mean, kids who are looked at as tough, kids who are come from nothing, you know. I know it's a cliche, but a lot of the kids I grew up with when I was young are dead, and some died young and violently, and a handful went to prison. And I got out of it, and actually creative writing saved my life.
Is this in the old mill towns of northern Massachusetts?
Yeah, mill towns. I lived in on the Merrimack River that, you know, flows west to east along the Mass-New Hampshire border. It's just a old bunch of textile towns. You know, Kerouac's from Lowell, mm-hmm. which is the town where I teach now. And, you know, I hated it. I hated every inch of every part of that world growing up, and now I'm happily living in the heart of it again. But writing saved me, man. It really did. It literally saved me physically, and it led me to me. And so I've been writing daily since I was about 22, and so that's a long time ago now.
Writing just seems to erupt from some people. It's like you can't stop it from happening. You have to release it. And is it that kind of process for you?
Well, it is. And I think it's true. Look, I think all human beings need to express themselves. And not everybody's going to do it with words. Some you need to paint. Some bake bread or quilt or, you know, do their flower garden. But people need to express. And so for me, to answer your question, you know, it's not always here's what happens. I did some acting in my 20s and early 30s, and I discovered I could go a year without acting. I felt fine. But I couldn't go 3 days in a row without writing, without feeling like, okay, my body just stepped 5 feet that way, but my soul is lingering behind. And now I get cranky. And even so, look, a day writing badly, you know, writing something I know I'm going to cut the next day is 100 times better than a day where I can't get to the desk at all. Hmm. And so, you know, there's a wonderful line from the writer Thomas Williams. He was asked why he writes. He said, oh, that's easy. I write so I don't die before I'm dead. And I think if someone finds that thing early on in life, it's a real blessing. I mean, and I feel really fortunate that I found that really young.
When you start writing, Andre Debuse, how formed is any idea about where this will end up?
It's not formed at all.
Really?
You know, there's no one correct way to do it, but I'm a big fan of not outlining. I'm a big fan of, you know, I love the line by the writer Richard Bauch. He said, look, if you think that you're thinking when you're writing, think again. Yeah. He said, you're much closer to the dreaming side of your mind, so dream it through. So for me, no, I begin with a sliver of an image. Like, you know, I've got this novel, The Garden of Last Days, in my hands right here, and it came out a few years ago. And it was an 800-page manuscript, and the opening image was, I just saw a wad of cash on a bedroom bureau, and I didn't know whose it was, how it got there, or anything. And I began to describe it, and that's what leads to everything. So it's all about curiosity.
Grab your headphones. We seem to have an audience that wants to talk to you. This is Andre Debuse III we're talking to here on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of House of Sand and Fog and the Garden of Last Days, Dirty Love. He's written a lot of works that you probably heard of. He'll be at Ashland High School tonight at 7:30. Chautauqua Poets and Writers brought him to town. And here is a call from Ryan and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange.
Well, hey, Jeffrey. It's been a while.
It has. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Of course, I've contributed my money to support JVR and IJVR. But thank you for this conversation because you touched on a number of things. And, of course, writing is the most miraculous human endeavor. I mean, ink spots on a piece of ground-up wood aren't, you know, I mean, it's like when you take that and you turn that into experience and in wisdom and learning, the fact that we can read something and actually experience it.
Yeah.
It isn't an artificial thing. It isn't an iPhone. The internet is not wisdom. The internet is a whole bunch of decontextualized and marketed data designed to get eyeballs. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like we have to figure out the difference. I mean, and I love the internet, okay, for the research and all the rest.
Yeah, I do too.
But I love your analogy of going into the opioid den of the world because I do see this as a drug.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, when I finish a good book and I get to that last page, and I have a deep sorrow that it's over. That's a drug, too. Just a better drug.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ryan. Good to hear from you.
Ryan, thank you.
Take care.
All right, so let's take another call here from Ann and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Andre DeBuse III.
Thank you. Well, I'm an inveterate reader. I always have a book that I'm listening to on CD and another book that I'm reading in print.
Wonderful.
I was a computer programmer for 17 years, and I made up for that high-tech career by being a neo-Luddite at home.
Hmm.
I do not own a cell phone. I do not own an iPhone or any computer device.
Wow.
I go to the library a couple of times a week and do research on the internet there. And that way, I also get 5.5 miles of bicycle exercise. So to me, the problem with the internet is that it is just as good at promulgating lies as it is in promulgating facts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the results of the 2016 presidential elections shows the danger of that, and that I don't see any solution to that problem, and I was wondering if you have any ideas. So thank you.
Well, Ann, you know, I do want to make some, you know, as you're speaking and talking about your own wonderful solitude, and I guess that's what I mourn more than anything is, especially in young people, there's great value to, as we know, those of us who are older and grew up without the gadgets, there's great value to walking down the street with nothing but the sounds in the air and the voices in your head. But I have to say, one of my dearest loved ones is very sick, and his entire life is on the gadget in his hand, and it saved his life, too. So I don't want to be a total curmudgeon on this. I mean, his connections in Facebook are wide and deep, and he writes these long, beautiful letters. I do want to say that one of my biggest fears about what the technology is doing to us is I think it's making us, first of all, less attentive, and there are studies that have shown this, that it's giving us all a bit of attention deficit disorder. It's recircuiting the brain. But I think my biggest sadness is that it's doing a number on our ability to stay present. And to your question about, well, how do we, you know, where do we find the difference between fake news and mendacity and the truth? Well, we have to become more reflective beings again, and the technology is against us doing that. So I think what you're doing is great. I think we have to find a way to step away from it. I mean, so many of my adult friends know how to have an iPhone and not let it take over their lives. But, you know, I don't know if I would be that strong. You know, I don't have one, and I think one reason why is I'd have to answer the 47,000 unopened emails I have, and that's not an exaggeration.
47,000 unopened?
Unopened.
So you have an email
There might
account.
Be some good... Yeah, you have to. You can't have a... You know, I teach as a professor. Oh. If without that, you know, my colleagues have to do the work, and so... It's a tough one. Hopefully we'll find the balance. But I love what the previous caller said, too, about reading. You know, what I love about reading is everything. And you know. But, you know, I was walking in an airport the other day, and, you know, there are 400 people in that terminal. 399 were staring at screens. I could have run naked through the terminal and taken their wallets. They wouldn't have noticed. But I did see one image that gave me great hope, Jeffrey. And it was
the other person running naked, taking people's wallets.
Yeah, that would be a power tour. Or him. No, it was a young woman sitting with, she had all the gadgets. She had she looked like a young businesswoman, probably 30 years old. She had a laptop open on her lap. She had an iPad over here. She had an iPhone over here, and she was reading a paperback. I said, oh my God, I needed to see that.
Andre DeBuse III is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is the author of The House of Sand and Fog and several other books. He'll be in Ashland High School tonight at 7:30. You can join us now on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Daniel in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Exchange.
Hi, Jeffrey and Andre. Just there are about 10,000 things to talk about, but one I wanted to acknowledge. I heard you on Oprah's show years ago.
Mm.
You delivered a sentence, I believe, came from your dad, and I've used it with my friends, but it's real simple. The job of a writer is to show up and to let something higher happen. Mm-hmm. And that just, and it's so brilliant, it just shakes my socks. But the next thing would be this, that if we find the internet really chock full of information, either good or bad, it doesn't seem to be the purveyor of wisdom. And the whole thing about a good story is it can shock people into wisdom. So how are we going to be able to tell wisdom stories over the internet, shock people back from their fascination with celebrity tattoos, and kind of like revivify, you know, our just the first principles that we live with that the very country has been founded on that don't seem to be evident anywhere in public discourse. But anyway, internet as a source of wisdom, how do we get there?
All right, thanks for that, Daniel.
Well, Daniel, I think you're right on. It's not a source of wisdom, it's a source of information. And we often in this culture confuse the two, information versus knowledge and wisdom. Seems to me that wisdom we have to live into, and we have to live into by making our mistakes and taking risks and looking for something higher. You know, for me, it's a cliche, but it's all about truth and beauty. It's all about trying to capture truths and receive them. And, you know, so as someone who writes primarily fiction, I'm talking about the small truths. Like if I can capture what it's like for this, you know, woman to wake up, you know, in her marital bed in 1943 in Ohio out of love with her husband who's at war, I might say something larger. You know, look, I'm no expert on the internet. The truth is I have never texted. The truth is I don't own an iPhone. The truth is I have a real problem with the handful of young men in Silicon Valley who invented it and got us all addicted to it. I do have hope. I'm not a pessimist. I tend to be an optimist. I do have hope in the same way that, you know, if a diet of Big Macs will make us sick and we'll start looking for something healthier to eat, a diet of constant reflections on a screen in our hand about mainly nothingness will eventually lead us hungry and empty and ready for more. And that's where the books are waiting, the poetry and the novellas and the novels and dance and theater and art, you know, art. There's a wonderful line from Tolstoy I love where he defines art in one sentence. He says, "Art is transferring feeling from one heart to another." Isn't that beautiful?
It truly is.
And that's it. You know, a good Springsteen song, a good Tom Waits song, a Picasso painting, a Steinbeck novel. And, yeah, so, Daniel, you know, beats me. I do think, though, that I have faith in people's ability to self-correct themselves. The people I'm worried about are young people whose literal formation is being affected by the technology, and that does scare me a bit.
You just rattled off a list of compositions and works. We can include Mozart's Requiem in there because I read in your interview with the New Yorker that we need grief to have joy. And I agree. It's a gorgeous piece of music. Unbelievably sublime.
Well, you know, I don't want to get on a high horse here, but I one of my criticisms of American culture is we're afraid of death and darkness, and we, you know, there's this sort of subliminal message that we all have to be happy. And, well, what's happy? Well, you got success is happiness. Well, it's all crap. No. Older cultures that we come from and some that we've butchered getting here know that it's all the above, that there is no joy without suffering. One of my favorite lines is from Khalil Gibran, that grief carves a crucible, you know, that container that holds molten steel. Grief carves a crucible in which joy is held. Now, my brother and I built my father's coffin, and we dug his grave.
Wow.
And it's a long story about how we got there. But at the end of it all, I come home. I was up all night building the coffin with my brother, and I come home, and I grab a book off the shelf just to get my mind off my father's premature death. And I'm reading. I was going to read a little bit. And here's the epigraph. It was an epigraph to a Graham Greene novel from a French writer, Léon Le Boy. And he said, "Man has places in his heart which do not yet exist, and into them enters suffering in order that they may have existence." You know, I think that one of my concerns about, not concerns, look, let's not, I just feel as if we're right. There's a whole new phrase now, by the way, by social psychologists, is that because of how we live our lives with the technology now, that everyone's kind of walking around in a state of continuous partial attention. And back to what I was saying earlier, we're only here for this one shot. And if it's 100 years, it ain't long enough. And so let's just be here. And so, you know, I didn't mean to get on my high horse about this, but I do find it's really difficult to teach creative writing. Not difficult. There's a whole new challenge in trying to get young people to step into nothingness with a pencil or pen or keyboard when they are not used to nothingness. In fact, they have filled it with noise as soon as they got their first cell phone at age 12 or their first video game. And so I think it's really important. One of my favorite lines from an ancient Chinese poet: we poets knock upon the silence for an answering music. But first, you guys, there has to be the silence. And we're too afraid of it in this culture, and that's all I'm saying.
That raises the question, though, about finding that balance, though, between darkness and light, between happiness and sorrow, and being careful not to create situations of drama and excitement in your life, just so
I
you
agree.
Can have the high points later.
Oh, yeah, man. Well, life's hard enough. I don't think anyone has to go out and create it. I do have friends. I'm sure you do, too. I've got a friend who thrives on crisis. She's got to have it. And whenever I see her, she comes into the house looking like she's just seen a horrible car accident. Every day, she needs it. Well, you know, we all have our flaws. I judge no one.
Andre Dubuse III is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're going to get off the internet rant here in just a bit and talk more about his works of fiction and his nonfiction work as well, including his memoir, Townie. He is at Ashland High School tonight at 7:30, brought in by Chautauqua Poets and Writers. We are in the middle, almost exactly the middle, of our fall fund drive here on Jefferson Public Radio, with 2 days left to go after this one and about $175,000 left to raise. No, that's actually a little high. $135,000. Let's put it that way. Anyway, you can take care of that, at least in part. 1-888-552-6191 with a pledge of support by phone or pledge online at ijpr.org. And as always, we say thank you for supporting JPR. Back on the Exchange in a minute five. Final segment at today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the author Andre Dubuse III. He has written House of Sand and Fog, The Cage Keeper and Other Stories, Blues Man, The Garden of Last Days, Dirty Love, Townie, a memoir among his works. He's at Ashland High School tonight at 7:30 speaking about writing. And he says it doesn't get easier over the years. We'll find out more about that in just a second. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I was thinking about the quote you gave a moment ago about needing sorrows to inform parts of our hearts that we didn't know existed. It sounds a lot like those times when you're running really scared, but you realize, wow, I got parts of my lungs I haven't used in a long time.
Yeah. I mean, I have a friend who got into the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London, and, you know, really hard to get there. And he's graduating. He does his MFA performance or whatever it is. And his teacher, who's a very famous Shakespearean actor, says, you know, Paul, that was a good performance. It wasn't great. I won't do the accent. He said, why? I worked my butt off. I did everything you're teaching me. He said, well, I don't know what to say, Paul. Just none of us are one note. We are all a symphony. And that's the thing. We are all a symphony. You know, one of my favorite lines is from Tom Waits, from one of his songs, Heart Attack and Vine. He says, and this is a line, excuse me, it's going to be blasphemy to some ears, but I think there's something really beautiful about it. There is no God. No, there is no devil. There's just God when he's drunk. Right?
Really?
Now, the reason I like that, if you look at the word pervert, right, it actually, I don't know if it's a Latin or Greek root, but it actually means to turn away from.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that mean? So someone who's living or, you know, who, you know, is a predator or some perverted perversion, you know, well, what's he turning away from? He's turning away from the light. He's turning away from something quite beautiful inside him. You know, bad babies aren't born. And so my point is, well, the reason I love that Waits line is I think it speaks to what I think the fiction writer's job is. Certainly I've seen my job over the years, is not to judge. Hemingway said that beautifully, actually, in a letter to his editor, Maxwell Perkins. The job of the writer is not to judge, but to seek to understand. So what I'm getting at, you ask about, you know, all parts of our human selves. I think that's the job of the artist is to paint all that, just to paint it. Not to solve the world, not to make a bunch of pronouncements, but just try to capture it. Just capture it.
Which is very almost journalistic of you, and you've been recognized for this by a lot of reviewers who've pointed out the fact that you're not saying, oh, look at the bad guy. You're just putting the people out there with all their flaws and letting readers make up their own minds or to continue not judging as well.
Yeah, and I wonder, though, I find this really beautiful and poignant about art in general and my experience of it as an audience member. You know when you're in the presence of it, and it has to, again, go back to Tolstoy, it has to do with some sort of transference of feeling, which can only happen, I would argue, with the illumination of truths. And they tend to be small ones. Yeah, that's what divorce feels like. Yeah, that's what alcoholism feels like. Yeah, that's what it feels like to get arrested. Yeah, that's what it feels like to be out of love and not knowing why, whatever. But I think the difference, there's a wonderful line, by the way, from Mike Nichols, the film director. He was asked, you know, what's the question the storyteller asks before creating story? He said, well, it's not what the journalist asks. What the journalist asks is what happened. But what the storyteller has to ask, or the question with which he or she has to grapple, is not what happened, but what's it like? What's it really like to be in this thing that's happened? And I don't know, there's a mystery here for me. I don't know why it's so satisfying to see truth revealed, but it feeds us in some way, doesn't it? I mean, when you see, I mean, even if it leaves you devastated, think, yeah, that's just what it feels like to lose a parent.
Well, one of my favorite lines is, the truth will make you free, but first it will make you miserable.
Yeah. Oh, beautiful. Yeah. Who said that? Woody Allen sounds like.
Probably, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's tough. It's hard to step into that zone, but it's so gratifying when, and I have to say, you know, during the break I was telling you that, you know, all these years I've been writing, which is all my adult life, which is, you know, a long time, it hasn't gotten easier in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I'm curious about that.
Which is weird, because I was a carpenter. I've been a carpenter my whole life. For the first 15 years of my writing life, that's how I made my living. You know, and, you know, the more decks I built, the better deck guy I was. The more roofs, the better roof guy, et cetera. But, you know, when you, like, I'll start a new piece, and, you know, it's as if I picked up my hammer, and I'm saying, well, what's a hammer? What do you do with this? And I'm not quite sure what's behind that. But it sure is invigorating to be that lost and scared.
I guess, if you did feel like you had it knocked, you'd probably put out hack work then, wouldn't you? I mean, this way you're thinking anew each time, it would seem.
I guess. I don't know. I mean, I've learned to make friends with my self-loathing and terror. No, now here it is. Now if I'm not feeling terrified and hating myself, I think I must be writing crap.
Well, let's talk about the self-loathing, because in Townie, you talk about looking at yourself in the mirror at age 14 and just feeling absolute loathing for yourself.
Yeah.
How did you survive yourself in those years?
Well, I was a victim, sadly, the way too many people are, of street violence. You know, I wasn't facing gun violence the way far too many people are now, mainly, you know, poor people. But, and I think I'm going to talk about this tonight, actually, because it led to my writing life. I began not to tolerate hating myself. Why did I hate myself? Because I went to about 14 schools before I got in high school. I was always a new kid. I was always victimized. And I felt that I was the way I was treated. And something really traumatic happened that changed all that, and I began to change my life by working out and by boxing, and, you know, I laid off of substances, and I was on a dark road for a while because it was physically violent, but I learned that you can change your life. It never occurred to me. Never occurred to me that you could change your life.
But that's a real sense of power for a teenager, isn't it?
Yeah, and it that was really important. That did changed everything, and right around then is when I found writing, and that changed my life too.
So it's one thing to write about yourself, and Townie came after several novels. But you know, obviously, in the course of telling a memoir, you're going to tell stories about your family. You have three siblings, your mother, your late father. I mean, so
that was the hardest part.
Uh-huh.
I finished it and sent it to my editor, and she said, "Well, this is all interesting about the violence and stuff, but didn't you live with people?" I say, yeah. Well, why aren't they in the book? Well, I don't want to violate their privacy, man. This is my little story. She said, but wasn't that part of your story? I said, yeah. So Richard Russo, the novelist, is a buddy, and I'm at some literary thing, and I said, hey, man, I know she's right, but I don't know where the line is. And he shared with me the most valuable advice, and maybe anyone out there listening who's writing about their own lives, this might help you. It's from Richard Russo. He said, look, if it were me, I'd ask myself, am I trying to hurt anybody with this book? He said, if the answer is yes, I wouldn't write it. Or I would write it, but I wouldn't publish it. And as soon as he said that, and he continued to say, but if I'm not trying to hurt anyone, then I go ahead and write it. And as soon as he said that, Jeff, I knew I wasn't trying to hurt anyone. I simply felt I was no longer mad at my mother and father. I no longer felt sorry for the boy I'd been. I simply felt compelled to try to capture as fully as I could what it was like to grow up a kid in a single mother household in first world poverty in dangerous neighborhoods, Vietnam limping to a finish, Nixon flying off in his helicopter, sex, drugs, and rock and roll from age 11 on, a lot of violence. And it finally, so his advice gave me permission to go ahead and be more honest.
In terms of getting into the minds of fictional characters, though, I mean, particularly dark ones, like you're basically detailing the inside life of a September 11th terrorist in the Garden of Last Days. Any places that just abjectly scare you? It's like, wow, I'm on this place now, and I don't want to stay here longer, but I got to finish this.
Most of them do scare me, you know. And again, I'm a firm believer in the same way you can't choose with whom you fall in love. You can't choose what you get drawn to creatively. And so in Garden of Last Days, I was writing it for about a year and a half, and one of the characters who's a composite of one of the 9/11 hijackers wants the mic. I said, I'm not giving you the mic. We know what you guys are about. I'm not going to. And he kept pulling on my sleeve. And so I realized I knew very little. So I had to read about 11 books, and I spent 6 months reading, 33 books.
Wow.
The Quran twice, History of Egypt, on and on. But this is the mystery and the beauty, right? So now I'm writing from the point of view of one of these guys, and I'm still thinking there's no way I'm going to be able to pull this off because I have no belief system remotely close to theirs. And how can you be so brainwashed to do what you guys did? Within the first half hour of the first writing session, I felt a real kinship with this young man because I, too, as a young man, embraced violent death, embraced it because I would rather actually die a violent death than see a coward in the mirror any longer. And so that was my way in, and it was a shared humanity that I never would have thought. But meanwhile, Jeff, I live north of Boston. Like, we lost about 60 people on those planes. Meanwhile, I'm driving by the house of a woman whose husband on that morning woke up his 3-year-old son at 5 in the morning and hugged him and told him what she loved him. He'd never done that. He'd traveled 3 times a week for his business as a salesman. He gave her a hug. She was pregnant. Said, I'm going to quit my job when I get back because I don't see you guys enough. He was on the first plane that went into that first tower. And here I am humanizing one of his killers. And now I'm driving by and seeing his widow playing with the daughter he never met and the son who's growing without him. And I'll tell you, the stakes are high when you're writing, when you're trying to write as freely and bravely as you can. And it's, but I think it's our job. You know, it's the task of the writer. And we're not always up for it, but we've got to find a way to get up for it because, you know, we got to get to work.
Well, good luck in teaching a new generation of writers at the University of Massachusetts Lowell.
Yeah, love them. I love my students.
Andre Dubuque III, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange at Ashland High School tonight at 7:30, brought in by Chautauqua Poets and Writers. Pleasure to meet you. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Pleasure to meet you. Thank you.